Whether you're walking barefoot in the snow, escaping for a walk on your lunch break, or trekking halfway across the world for a lush view, it feels good when we unplug and connect to our simpler side. If only our everyday nutrition were that simple. It's time to simplify your wellness routine with Ka'Chava. Getting the nutrition we need from that graveyard of supplements in our cupboards is often overcomplicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, keep it simple with just 2 scoops that have the highest quality ingredients. Simplify your nutrition at ka'chava.com and use code FITNESS. New customers get $20 off an order of 2 bags or more now through January 31st. That's ka'chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code FITNESS.
Welcome to the Women in STEM podcast that focuses on the intersectionality of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We focus on how we can amplify the voices of women in STEM and make them aware of the multiple different career opportunities that are available.
Welcome to the Women in STEM podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yes, of course. Hi, my name is Sabria. I am a trained cell biologist, so a scientist currently working as a science editor, previously doing research in cell biology and transitioned into editing 4 years ago. I am originally Mauritian, but born in the UK, and I'm really excited for this conversation. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. It's great to have you on. Now, I'm wanting to get a bit more into your career and really hearing about all the interesting stuff that you've done. So what inspired you to pursue a PhD in cell biology? And what was the moment you knew that you wanted to pursue this as a career path?
It's a really good question, and I'm wondering how to answer this without going into sort of the full-on story. The truth is, I wasn't planning on doing a PhD. It wasn't, you know, something that I set myself out to do whilst I was doing my undergraduate degree and had set myself that as a goal. It's really something that came out of me not going down a different route that I had actually planned. So I was interested, so if we backtrack a little bit, I was interested in going for medical school when I finished my high school studies. I was into science from quite a young age, and did biology, chemistry, physics and math. And that was really the original path, was to go into medical school. And it is through trying to get into medical school and not getting into medical school that led me onto the path that eventually got me onto doing a PhD. So I did an undergraduate degree here in the UK in biomedical sciences, again, with the intention of going into medical school after graduating from that. But again, once I applied to medical school after the undergraduate, I didn't get into medical school. I ended up shifting gears to do a master's by research. So here in the UK, we have a master's and MSc, which is different to a master's by research in the sense that the research one has more of a focus on research program. And it's through really doing that master's by research where I had a 6-month lapse of time to do a research project in the lab, gather data, that I really got exposed to the scientific method, setting up experiments to test a hypothesis, gather data, analyze it, and then draw conclusions. And I think it was then, I don't think I realized it back then because I was still very intent on going into medical school. And that was the plan. That was always the plan. And after my master's, that's what I intended. But somewhere that was born through doing that research project. And again, the story goes, I applied for the third round into medical school after completing my master's. It was a year. Didn't get accepted into the postgraduate cohort. And it was at that point that I thought, okay, maybe I actually do enjoy this research and being in the lab and answering questions. Perhaps let's try and explore that route. And so that was when I decided, well, maybe going down the research route through doing a PhD would be interesting. And the other motivation at the time was also I enjoyed teaching. I'd been teaching doing some undergraduate teaching and supporting in lab practicals for the undergraduate students. And I really came alive when I was doing that because it allowed me to apply the principles that I was learning and share it with, you know, the younger generation. And I thought, well, lecturing could be an option. And usually our lecturers have a PhD. So it was at that point that I applied for multiple PhD programs and then ended up getting onto the one that I ended up getting onto. So it wasn't a very sort of calculated decision that, I'd set myself a target to go off and do a PhD. It was more something that came as an evolution of another plan not working out and then exploring sort of an alternative option. But having said that, once I did it, I was very glad that I did because I enjoyed it very much.
Yes, I find your pathway there to be quite intriguing. I know that some people contemplate doing a PhD, but there's still a lot of barriers or misconceptions for people who are not aware of PhDs. For example, one of them being that you need to be like super, a lot more mature in age, or you need to be super, super smart. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you've heard about PhDs, especially in highly technical fields like yours?
Yeah, I think some of the ones that you mentioned were some of my own misconceptions actually. And going back to the previous question, it was probably also why that was never really on the plan. Because I remember it was a lecturer that had said to me, well, if you do want to go on to the route of lecturing, then you probably have to deepen your research, and therefore to do that, you can go off and do a PhD. But it was never something that I saw myself capable of doing, because like you say, I think I also thought, oh, you have to be super smart. How can you do a research project that lasts over 4 years? It just seemed like a very, very long time. And I think that's a misconception because, I'm pretty average and it worked out fine. And so the thing about a PhD is I think people sort of see the title and are thinking, oh, wow. But it's really something that you attain, after that long period of time. But during it, a PhD teaches one how to think. That's how I really see PhDs. It's not that when you're starting or when you're on it, you sort of conquered it and you know everything. And actually, ironically, by the end of the PhD, and I've heard other people say this as well, you actually feel like you know nothing because you end up sort of uncovering all these new questions. And you realize sort of the immensity of it whilst your project is focused on something very, very specific. And of course, you advance knowledge, which is the point of doing a PhD in a specific field. But, there's an immensity there. So I think one of the biggest misconceptions is A, thinking, that you need to be super smart and have everything together to do it. I see it as it's a training to think critically, to evaluate data, and to learn how to do research. That's one of the biggest misconceptions. The second misconception I would say that I also had as well is that one needs to just know how to direct their project from the beginning and know what the next question is to ask and what direction to take the project. That whilst that is true of some PhD students, I think probably some very brilliant ones, it all depends on what background people have had before getting to that point. Right. And you mentioned earlier the age. I don't think it's so much an age. I think it's more the experience that one has before embarking onto a PhD. And by default, it's a postgraduate program. One doesn't start with a PhD, one does at least a bachelor's degree. And then some people go straight into PhD, others go off and do a master's, like I did, and then get to a PhD. But I think it's that research experience that you build before you get onto it. And that looks different for different people and maybe different in different countries as well. So it's normal that certain students might seem really gifted at the start and then they know where their project is going, they know exactly what direction to take it in and are quite independent from the beginning. But I would say not to, for students not to put pressure, that kind of pressure on themselves, especially at the beginning, because I mean, I certainly did. I could see people around me in the lab, some who weren't even at the same level that I was, as in they were further on in their PhDs or they were post-PhD trainees. And they, they had such autonomy and independence. They knew where their project was going. They came up with new ideas. And I didn't really have that at the beginning, but it came with time, right? So it's sort of allowing oneself to evolve in that program. And it's that length of time, 3 to 4 years for a reason for one to develop. So yeah, I think those misconceptions did exist, but it really isn't true. I think people should go for it.
You've done research, you've spoken at the TEDx stage, and now you're working as the editor at Natural Cell Biology. How did your PhD prepare you for the path you've taken, both in and beyond the lab?
Again, so going back to the story I was telling you, once I embarked onto the PhD, I had a new sort of career plan, which was to go into the research and perhaps I had sort of two options. I would either go carry on and go into opening up my own lab and directing the research, because by the time I got onto the PhD, I enjoyed the whole method. I mean, I had enjoyed it as a master's student, even as an undergraduate doing my final year project, which involved a lab project. I really enjoyed the time in the lab. I mean, it was hard, don't get me wrong. There were moments of doubt and, depression when things didn't work out, but I just enjoyed the process so much that I figured rather than becoming a medical doctor, I would like to carry on this research and academic path and then open my own research lab and, direct, answer questions and have a research program. But I would say going through the actual PhD itself, obviously it gave the background that was needed to, like I say, ask research questions, develop hypotheses, and then develop experiments to test and answer these hypotheses. So that was definitely the training, so the scientific method and understanding what it involves in when you're answering a question, designing experiments to address it, and then interpreting the data, and then how you then ask the next questions. So that was the very solid foundation that the PhD gave, which was a preparation for a career in the lab or even, on a research path. But once again, that plan didn't go to plan. I ended up doing a postdoctoral research training, which is essentially a period of time post PhD where people who want to stay on the research, sort of pure research track, they tend to do that. Sometimes two postdocs, which are short contracts, well, I say short, 3 to 4 years contracts, that further deepens the training in doing research. And I went on to that because, like I say, the plan was to eventually be able to apply for my own fellowships and grants, funding to then answer my own research questions in my own lab. But then the plan changed again, and there was another twist in life. And after that postdoctoral training, I did that for 4 years. It coincided with the COVID pandemic, and I decided actually I might pivot careers and go into science editing. I still wanted to remain within the science arena, if you like, and use my background and my training. And so I moved into science editing because that had been an interest again that I had developed during my PhD and more so in my post-PhD times, my postdoctoral training. I was more interested in sort of the bigger picture because when we're doing a PhD, we're very focused on a specific question and it tends to be very niche because we're very hyper-focused on answering that question and we're really an expert in that field, which is great. But with science editing, it's more the bigger picture. So what is the entire field, where it's at, and what are the questions? And I was always quite interested in sort of understanding sort of the bigger picture around the question that I was answering. And so I shifted into science editing and actually had a different role before my current role at Nature Cell Biology. And then 2 years ago, I joined the Nature Cell Biology team. But my PhD is completely needed. I mean, it's a requirement when you're a science editor to have a PhD at minimum. And I was lucky to have had postdoctoral training. But it trained me how to, like I said earlier, think, understand research questions. Because as a science editor, what I'm doing is I'm evaluating other people's research, essentially. And that background of having done the research myself produced results that I then also published into a science journal. So we all tend to do this as PhD students or even postdocs. That whole training was very important for my current role, because publishing is the currency, if you like, of researchers. It's a measure of productivity. It's not a great measure of productivity, but it's one of the biggest measures of productivity. So, what have you done in the lab? If it's published and out into the open, one can see, well, that's the progress that we've made. So, yeah, my training really helps me very much. And also, thinking critically about the research is super important as a science editor because I have to be very unbiased when I look at people's research and evaluate if it's appropriate for the journal and if not, what amendments can be made. So, yeah, it's a the PhD was really great, really. It's the technical skills that's very focused on the science, which of course one gets when they do a PhD and one applies outside of the lab as a science editor. But I would like to actually highlight there's also the soft skills and the more transferable ones that maybe not are not quite apparent. And one doesn't, intentionally set out to develop these when they're doing a PhD. And that's adaptability, adapting to change. I lived in different countries over the time of my training. It's very common for people in research to do placements in different labs, across the city, across the country, across the world. to get different experiences, and that's really helped me adapt to change. The publishing landscape is extremely fast moving, and that's one of the transferable skills. And then also, I would say communication skills. As a PhD student, you're asked to present your work sort of in multiple different forums, whether it's the lab meetings, whether it's in conferences or, internal seminars. So those communication skills also obviously I apply in my job. So yeah, multiple different elements that the PhD helped with developing.
You touched on a bit about doing a PhD and depression, and I can imagine that sometimes doing a PhD can be quite isolating. And I wanted to know if you could speak to particularly for women of color and those coming from underrepresented backgrounds. What helped you stay grounded, and what advice would you give to others who are navigating that space?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The PhD can be isolating, and it is by nature, because so oftentimes in the technical side of things, we're so focused on a very specific topic that maybe very few people in the world are looking at, or even maybe none at all. And so it's sometimes hard to sort of discuss with colleagues. Obviously, we can discuss at a high level, but sometimes you're very alone with your project. So there's that aspect. And then there's the aspect of, well, it's a very solitary practice when you're doing a research project, because it's you and your project. You are directing that project, you're responsible for it, you have to do the experiments for it, and then ultimately write it up to then, produce a thesis. And so it is a very sort of singular, even if most people are not working in isolation, there are other people working in the labs around you doing their own research. But ultimately, you have sole responsibility. It's not like it's a group project or a team project that we often see in the workplace, where there's multiple people working on one big project towards a common goal and everybody has their role to play. Here, it's very much, obviously, other people are helping you, but you are very much responsible for that project. You set it out, you plan the experiments, you do it with advice from your supervisors, and you ultimately defend your data in your viva, which is sort of the culmination of the PhD. And so it is isolating in that respect. And I think a lot of people, some people enjoy that, so they don't really have to interact with anybody. And you can do that if you wish not to interact with anybody. I don't recommend it. But what I did to stay grounded, and like you touched upon in your question, it can be more so isolating for certain ethnic minorities, where, for example, you don't see other people who are maybe belong to the same background or have the same experiences as you do, and therefore you can't really relate on that level. And that was definitely the case for me, and I think not just myself, but other people that are maybe still doing PhDs. I would say to sort of not close in on yourself, and that's something I wish I'd told myself many years ago, because I'd had a tendency to do that. But open up. It's fine not to engage in everything that people are doing around you, but the more open we are, I think the more we draw people in. And something that I used to do, which in hindsight I realized helped me navigate, I used to really enjoy talking to PhD students that were further along the line to me than I was. And also postdoctoral researchers in the lab that I was in who'd obviously done their PhDs and were now furthering their training. I used to spend, have coffee with them, have lunch breaks with them. And it was talking about sort of this bigger picture, the person behind it, what struggles they faced, and how they overcame that. And I found that that really helped put things into perspective. And it helps one another share shared experiences. So you realize you're not the only one that's feeling the way you feel, the frustration, the depression. There are others out there, and that there's, more importantly, I think, there's light at the end of that sort of long journey, and you'll make it. So I would say leaning into the people around you, the circles that you're in, whether it's the direct environment, so the lab itself, the other people in the lab, or in many universities or research institutes, there are sort of student unions or, multiple different community groups. Definitely find that support group, whether if it looks like outside of the lab, that's fine as well, or a group of friends, to stay sort of grounded in reality. Because once again, because we're so focused on doing the research and you're spending hours and hours in a very sort of closed, confined environment, which labs usually are, it is important to have something that keeps you anchored, whether it's friends that are completely outside of your research environment, the lab, maybe don't even know what you're doing. I think that's even better. That can then sort of just keep you grounded in reality. So I would say, yeah, finding that support system, whether it's within the lab or outside of the lab, is very important. And even if you can't talk about the research directly to these people, it's again just talking about sort of other things and the broader challenges that keeps things together. For me, my parents were a very grounding base, even if, you know, I was in a different country to them whilst I was doing my PhD. They never understood what I was doing, bless them. But I was able to have that space to discuss whatever it is I was feeling, and they would listen. And I also had friends that were completely outside of research, that I used to see at the weekends, for example, and it just brought that breath of fresh air and just put things and life into perspective. So that's what I would say.
I mentioned earlier on about the fact that you've spoken at TEDx and you're also a trained public speaker. I think oftentimes people associate somebody doing PhD or wanting to do higher learning to be very shy and to be, not wanting to get on a stage and to talk about it. So how can PhD students get better at communicating their work in both academic and non-academic audiences? As you mentioned, like your parents don't quite understand what you do, but I'm sure you at some point need to be able to bridge that gap with helping people who don't fully understand your research to get some basic understanding. So how best do you communicate that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think it's a very important one as well for a PhD students across the board of, you know, just all science field and maybe non-science fields to be able to communicate the research. And there's importance that lies beyond just communicating it to people who aren't doing the research or who don't even come from a research background. It becomes important because research relies on funding, and I see that communication of the science or the research an absolute pillar in building public trust in what the research is about. And we've seen the importance of doing that, for example, with the COVID vaccine, and there are many other examples. So the program that I was on didn't have a specific communication course per se. I remember there were one-off workshops that we'd have to attend on the program that I was on specifically, which was to communicate the research in layman terms. And we had sort of a competition to write lay abstracts. These are all very good because it can be quite difficult, I think, to break down the specifics of what we're doing to someone who isn't at all in the research background, or who might be, but is just not in that particular field. And so it would still need a high level understanding. And I think the PhD students that can learn to do this are the ones that probably somehow get ahead. And how, your question was how students can do this. I would say taking opportunities. There are many competitions, I think, and that's probably the case all over the world, whether it's a sort of elevator pitch, PhD, or, you know, 1 minute spiel of what you're doing. Enter these competitions, even if, you know, they don't work out in the way that you expect it. It'll give that experience of, well, how can I, you know, how can I actually break this down into and distill the concepts into a very simple 1 minute presentation of what it is, what's the question that I'm asking, how I'm addressing it, and what impact the data and the results will have, why this is all important. So I would say, you know, students to take these opportunities and take the informal opportunities, like you mentioned. Sometimes just talking to our family and friends about what we do is also a way of, it forces us to really break it down and bring it back to the very basics of what it is we're doing. And it's incredibly important. And I don't think communication is given enough of an emphasis in PhD programs. I certainly speak for PhD programs in the UK. It might be different in maybe the US or Europe or elsewhere. But I actually just came back yesterday from a science conference. So conferences are where people come together and we discuss the science and there are presentations. And it's such a sharp contrast between the communication side. So I enjoy communication, particularly the oral communication. It's an interest of mine, hence why I ended up training in public speaking. But comparing sort of what people do in the science field versus sort of what communication courses teach us. Sometimes they're sort of polar opposite. And, for example, we're told don't pack the slides so intensely that people can't, even understand or even follow what you're trying to say. This is totally fine in science conferences because people have a very limited amount of time to convey everything. And to me, it's like, well, distill the main point, don't present everything. But a lot of people, and it's completely accepted in the field that everybody would just race through their presentation, even if nobody's or very few people are following because, they're so into the field. So I always find that very interesting how there are just such differences in just culturally what's accepted, as in within the science, versus, if you're on a communication course, you should just be told not to do any of these things. So I do think there isn't enough emphasis, and also that maybe we need a culture change in how we present our work and, what emphasis do we place on actually presenting, whether it's at science conferences, at posters, etc. But I do think it's incredibly important, particularly for people who want to stay on the research track, because like I mentioned earlier, I mean, I didn't end up going down that route, even if that was one of my plans. But for researchers to pitch their research and their research questions to funding bodies, ultimately they do have to write very good grant proposals to get the funding, but also at some point they'll have to defend it orally, so make a presentation and pitch, a bit like businesses pitching for investments. It's pretty much the same concept. And so it's a very important skill to have, I think, communication of research in a manner that people that are not experts will understand.
Yes, and as you know, this is the Women in STEM podcast, and time again, we always manage to go back to the topic around confidence, especially with women. So, as somebody who talks at these different events, I'm curious to know if you have any advice with regards to public speaking and overcoming fears and anxiety of feeling like you're not smart enough or you're not qualified enough to speak on a specific topic.
It's funny because I still battle that feeling myself, whether I'm asked to talk on certain podcasts or invited to certain stages. I'm sort of thinking, why have they asked me? So all to say, I'm not an expert in this myself, and it's still a work in progress for me personally to overcome that. But what I'm learning so far with regards to confidence and I guess that feeling of imposter syndrome, where we think we're not qualified enough or smart enough, I think it's grounding oneself in the why. Why, if we're accepting a speaking opportunity or an invitation to share thoughts on a certain topic, what do we hope the audience or the listeners are going to get out of it? And then anchor yourself in that why, rather than thinking and worrying about, I don't know if what I'm going to say is going to be good enough, of value enough, and share really from the heart and quite sincerely. And I think, or at least personally, when I frame it that way, I see it as an act of service. And I might not be the best person to talk about it, or I might not be giving the greatest value, and someone else could be better at that. But I'm sure that I'm sharing from a place of my lived experience and reflections that I have, made with hindsight, and that maybe somewhere someone is listening to that. So I think, and it resonates with them. So I think it's just silencing those voices in our head that tell us we're not smart enough or good enough, and thinking about the why and making it bigger than yourself. Like, this isn't about me coming on a stage and looking great and talking about it. What do you want a person to think or feel, or what action do you want them to take as a result of listening to you? And if it's, I think that's quite an empowering and a positive way of framing it. And that gets me through, certain talks when I am thinking in the back of my head, oh, I'm not smart enough or qualified enough. And with regards to the actual speaking itself and the technicalities behind it, personally, I still get very, very nervous, no matter what speaking it is, whether it's on a stage, whether it's on a call or. And I think somewhere that's a normal physiological reaction. It's the body reacts that way. It's the adrenaline that's going through. And we're either, fighting or flighting. And it's fine to feel fear, but once again, reminding oneself of that why. And then on a more practical sense, it's like a muscle. Public speaking, to me, it's a muscle. The more you exert it and work it, the sort of more developed it becomes and the stronger it becomes. So practice, right? Sort of not setting too sort of high and unrealistic expectations. Mistakes will happen. We'll live and learn from them, and that's fine. And again, I think confidence is also a muscle. Some people come across outwardly very, very confident, but I think that comes from years of sort of training and pushing through that fear or riding the wave of the fear and sort of just going with it anyway and being okay with that uncomfortable feeling that maybe I'm going to fail or I'm going to slip up. But at the end of the day, we're all human, and that's fine to do. So yeah, sort of pushing through and practicing and thinking of the bigger why of what one is sharing, I think can get us through this. I'm not good enough or I'm not smart enough. I don't think one can ever be smart enough or qualified enough.
And finally, coming to the last question, there might be some people who have listening to this podcast because they're contemplating starting their journey in a PhD. And I'm curious to know, what is one thing that you wish somebody had told you right at the beginning of your journey?
It's a really profound question. And I was reflecting on this and the other day, actually, because someone else asked me this, that someone I know is going off to do a PhD. I wish at the time that I had started my PhD that someone would have, I guess, given the reassurance that it's okay if you don't have all the answers at the beginning, that you don't have it all figured out, that you have a perfect schedule and you're churning out data, you're super productive, that you will actually stumble in the start, because it's a very steep learning curve, even for people who've done some research before. And there's suddenly this independence and autonomy and this responsibility, because there's money associated with doing a PhD and doing research, and so there's that responsibility. But I wish someone had said to me, you're not going to have all the answers at the beginning, and that is the purpose of the PhD. You'll have to go through it, and as you allow yourself to develop, you will those answers will come. These sort of next levels will unlock, and it will get better. Because I think at the beginning, I put a lot of pressure on myself to perform and to be, and of course, other people were better around me or just sort of had it figured out, and I didn't, and it made me feel, again, not good enough, not qualified enough. And to my surprise, a lot of people in the lab that I was in, but it was only very many years down the line, even if we'd been in the same lab for like 3, 4 years. But it's only when we started talking about it, they said, yeah, actually, I felt like that as well at the beginning. And I was, mortified. But we don't really like sharing these sorts of experiences because, we're supposed to look like we know what we're doing as PhD students. It's fine if you have no idea what you're doing. It's really okay. The important thing is to move forward and be open to learning and just be a sponge. Talk to people around you, lean on other people, more experienced people's experiences, and sort of be open and have that sort of humility within you that it's going to be fine. And I think this isn't told enough in PhD labs, in research labs, because it's just the culture of research. Everybody wants you to be very productive at the beginning. There's no time to waste. You have to get data and get results and be running around like a headless chicken sometimes. I wish someone had said to me, it's actually okay for you to step back, take your time and learn. Not slack, obviously, but give yourself the time to adapt and learn, and as you go along, and it'll be fine by the end of it. So yeah, just giving yourself grace when you're starting your PhD, and I would say definitely go for it because it's such a big, bold, and brave and beautiful step. And I would encourage everybody. And actually, one thing I would like to say at the end, if I may, have a very strong, once again, why you're doing the PhD. Have that very clear. And it doesn't matter what it is, as in no matter what it is, whether it's because you want to become a professor, because you want to open your own research lab, because you want to become a lecturer, because you want to have the title of PhD, whatever it is, that is a strong anchor for why you're doing the PhD. And the reason is, it does get hard, it does get tough. And there are very many moments when we just want to sort of give up and just, it feels so dark that we're thinking, maybe I'm not cut out for this. Maybe this isn't meant for me after all, or I'm not very good. And maybe that is the case, right? That you just don't feel like this is quite for you. And we don't know until we try, right? But it's in those times that we need to remember our why. we're doing it, and that keeps us moving forward. Sort of what is that end goal, and have that very clearly in sight. And that keeps us going and keeps us open to the learning.
It's been wonderful having you on the podcast and hearing all your answers. Can you please tell us to the listeners where they can find you, where they can connect with you?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful chatting to you. The time just flew by. But yep, I am on social media, a couple of social media platforms. I'm on LinkedIn, Sabria Karim. If you look through there, you will definitely find me. I try and post every now and then some reflections. I'm also on Instagram. The handle is at sabria.speaks. That's where you can find me posting reflections or fun things that happen as a science editor at conferences. There is a website coming up soon. It is currently still under construction, but www.sabria.com. You'll be able to find updates there and perhaps little videos. But yeah, it's been really a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the Women in STEM podcast.
Listeners, if you've enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite streaming platform, leave a review and rating to help us reach more listeners, and follow our social medias, the latest updates and behind the scene content. Join us next week for another exciting episode. And until then, keep exploring the world of STEM and empowering women in STEM.